This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about a subject some people consider unspeakable. What happens to a body after death? My guest has a good reason for talking about it. He thinks if people understand this, they will be more likely to donate their organs after death. I'll explain in a moment, but I should advise you some listeners might find the explicit nature of our interview disturbing. Dr. Kenneth Iserson directs the Arizona Bioethics Program at the University of Arizona, where he's also a professor of surgery. He practices emergency medicine and is the medical director of Southern Arizona's major search and rescue operation. In his new book, Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies, he says that approximately 25 different organs and types of tissues can be used for transplant now, and the list is growing. Yet, Americans aren't donating. He wants you to know that your corpse is going to end up looking pretty bad no matter what, so you might as well consider donating your organs when you go.
Death is a mutilating experience no matter what you do. So be generous and help the living.
What are some of the fears people have about donating their organs?
There's a number of fears, Terry, and they're culturally based. One of the great fears is that they're going to become organ and tissue donors before they really had to die. That's actually obviated in our society because the rules are is that a different medical team has to be taking care of you than the team that decides on, for example, death by brain criteria, brain death, or the team that takes your organs. That's a major fear. Others, which are about how the body is going to be treated after death, are that embalming won't be possible or an open casket funeral won't be possible if you donate your organs and tissues.
Is that
not
true?
Not true at all. Not true at all. In fact, modern morticians are specifically trained in how to restore bodies, make them presentable, if nearly every organ and tissue that's possible to take has been taken. And they can still have the open casket funeral. And as we say, only your mortician knows for sure.
Do you find a lot of people are afraid of the pain, even though rationally they know they'd be dead by the time the organs were removed?
That doesn't seem to be a big determinant. It's more the question that, boy, the body's going to be mutilated. They've suffered enough. But in fact, the people that are suffering are the ones that need the organs and tissues to continue a full life or to have a full life. And as you said early on, no matter what you do, being dead is a mutilating experience.
Well, I want to warn our listeners that some people will be absolutely fascinated by these details, and other people will be very uncomfortable hearing them. So, listeners, be advised. I want to talk with you first about the viewing of bodies. You know, when you see a body laid out in a funeral home, it gives you the idea that you can actually be quite attractive in death, nicely dressed and made up, and people can leave the funeral saying, he looked good.
He looked good.
you give a lot of fascinating details about how this illusion of looking good is created. Let's start with how a mortician can get rid of the pain or suffering on a dead person's face.
Well, the whole industry calls it making a beautiful memory picture, which is what you've just described. They actually massage the muscles and the facial structures to allow some of the muscles to relax and to ease some of the contractures that have gone on in the facial muscles. And some of these are just postmortem changes, and some of them may have been looking like the person was in agony. But it's all smoke and mirrors, as they say. It doesn't do anything to help the person, of course. They're dead.
If rigor mortis has set in and the body has stiffened, how does the mortician move the body around? For instance, get the arms crossed across the chest?
Oh, well, sometimes, actually, it's almost impossible to do it if, depending on the state of when they get the body. But indeed, rigor mortis comes on at various times, at various speeds, and then wears off. So the body eventually does become loose. So again, it depends when the mortician actually gets the body. But they can oftentimes massage the muscles and get them into a certain position. Once they have embalmed the body, however, it often takes on fairly rigid type of position, at least for a while. And so they have to be careful about how they position the body.
Mm-hmm. One thing that really amazed me, some body parts are kept in their positions with the help of super glue or rubber cement.
Super glue has long been used by embalmers to keep eyes closed, keep mouths closed, to do other kind of things, sealing certain holes in the body. So kind of magic.
If eyes are closed after death, will they open if they're not glued shut?
They can be partially open if they're not glued shut. They're always kept shut one way or another. There's something called an eye cap also that can be used with or without the super glue, and it's put under the eyelids, and it has little ridges on it, and it holds the tissue closed from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's one reason why eyes are donated so frequently, even oftentimes without family's knowledge. In some states, that's permissible. Because truly, there's no way of anyone else telling other than the mortician whether the eyes have been donated, because you're going to be putting something in to replace any eyes that are taken out. The eyes are going to always be closed.
Yeah, once a body is buried in mm-hmm. the coffin in a cemetery, and it hasn't, it's either not been embalmed or it's just been embalmed for the viewing. Does it decompose in the coffin?
Oh, sure. And In fact, what is thought is that these so-called hermetically sealed coffins, the real expensive ones that, you know, can go up to $6,000 or more,
yeah.
That are airtight, will in fact enhance decomposition, will speed it up. So sure, the body is decomposed. Now, what parts decompose first? The parts that did not have embalming fluid. In fact, there's studies going on right now by forensic anthropologists centered mainly in the Tennessee area to find out exactly how bodies that are partially embalmed, more fully embalmed, not embalmed, buried at different levels, and in different types of coverings will decompose. And that's to help forensic scientists out when they investigate bodies.
You know, the coffin doesn't decompose, right?
Well, it depends on the type of coffin. Now, Orthodox Jews who actually have the most ecologically sound way of disposing of the body are buried in wooden coffins without any metal in them. Those coffins decompose. They're just usually fairly plain wood, and they will decompose along with the body. Metal coffins, on the other hand, were originally not allowed in many cemeteries throughout the world because naturally they won't decompose, or at least any time within multiple generations.
So if you're in a coffin with metal in it, you don't really quite return to the earth, do you?
Not really. Not really. And that's been a real complaint of cemeterians, people who run cemeteries, as well as certain religions, because the whole idea was that it was supposed to be dust to dust.
You looked into cremation
uh-huh.
As part of the research for your book. What is the process for cremating a body? How is it burned?
As quickly as possible. The body is not usually embalmed, except in rather unusual circumstances. It can be put in just a shroud, which is a covering, a sheet covering of the body, or more typically, it's put into some kind of box. It can be put into a large cardboard box, which the funeral directors are required to be able to supply, or into a coffin. It's then put into a crematory, the oven itself. It's turned on, and the covering, whatever the covering is burned, and the body. The remains, cremated remains, sometimes called cremains, are actually just the residual of the bone without the organic matter in there. Many funeral
Is the bone the only thing that turns to ash?
Right. It's not really ash. It's actually bony remnants that are left. The only ash, as it were, is from a coffin or shroud or clothing or anything else the person had on. The other things that are left are any metal that's in the body. People say, well, I don't have any metal in my body, especially because pacemakers are usually removed because of the danger. But people have orthopedic appliances, you know, if they've had surgery. Many people now have wire sutures or staples inside their body because of surgeries they've had.
What about the fillings in your teeth?
Fillings in your teeth. They're not usually removed, and people say, well, why don't you remove the fillings? You know, they're gold or they're, you know, silver or they're other precious metals. In fact, just economically, it's not worthwhile. So they'll end up in the urn with the cremated remains. Many funeral homes, many crematories, will actually grind the remains so you don't have recognizable bone fragments left, but some don't. And you're left with 3 to 5 pounds for an adult of cremated remains.
So is the gold from your teeth going to be in that box that they send you?
Sure will.
What do people do with it? Do people ever pick that out?
Not usually, no. Uh-huh. In fact, most people... In talking with people, most of them actually do look to uh-huh. see what's in the box, whether or not they're going to be scattering it. But they don't paw through the box, and the metal will probably sink to the bottom before they actually look in the box.
My guest is Dr. Kenneth Iserzin, head of the bioethics program at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the new book, Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Kenneth Iserzin, author of the new book, Death to Dust. You are, among other things, an emergency room physician. And as we said before, one of the reasons why you wrote this book is that you'd like people to think more seriously about donating their organs when they die and to be assured that their body will be mutilated whether they donate their organs or not, because, as you say, death is a mutilating experience. Are you often in the position of trying to talk to family members as somebody is dying or has just died, trying to convince the family to have that person's organs donated? That's such a sensitive subject. And what an awful time to have to talk to a family about that.
You're absolutely right. I've talked to people over my career as an emergency physician, both about donating their loved ones' organs and tissues, and also the question of autopsy when they weren't automatically a medical examiner's case. It's a terrible time to be talking to people, and in this case, people who I've never met before, because as an emergency physician, I've never met this patient. I've never met this family, you know, unlike the general practitioner or the surgeon or others who may have known these folks ahead of time. But there is a limited amount of time that's available in which to donate organs and tissues. And so we have to ask. We have to ask early on. It helps. In many, many states now, they have a checkoff on the back of the driver's license. We often have driver's licenses for these people and it says, yes, I would like to donate my organs and tissues. And we show that and we ask the family whether they will go along with this person's wishes.
How do you bring it up to the family?
Well, in fact, in my situation, I have a double trouble role as it is. I first have to tell them that he has died or she has died. After that, with the same team, usually nurses, their own family support group, our chaplain, we've used our morticians who are specially trained in the past. I go ahead and would ask them, prefacing it, I guess, first with the fact that it's an awful time to be asking this, but we don't have any choice because there's a limit on time. If they want to give the gift of organs and tissues from their loved one to help others. In fact, many families are very thankful that they get asked because they want to do it, but they're not willing to bring up the subject They may not even have thought about the subject right at that point in time. But they are glad that someone is asking. And in fact, we know from large studies, as well as personal experience, is that afterwards they feel good about that, especially, I mean, we're a major trauma center, and we see a lot of young people who tragically die. This allows them to know that many people are often helped by the donations of organs and tissues from their loved one.
So I guess a lot of people find some, if not consolation, but find something in the idea that the person who they love so much who has died will, in their death, be at least helping to save someone else's life.
Sure, because if you think about it, we're not saying they're going to help one person, but if they donate both eyes, they're going to help two people see again, mm-hmm. perhaps people hear again with ears, the ear bones that can be transplanted, skin for burn victims. By the way, maybe we should say something just about the skin. I talk to people about skin donations and they go, ugh, skin, you know. But in fact, the layer of skin that they take is no more than a sunburn that peels off in a sunburn. So it's almost nothing. And it's usually in areas like in the back where they can't see it. But they can take bones, the pancreas, now in some cases the intestines, certainly hearts, lungs, livers, kidneys, you know, on and on. And the list is growing.
If you want to donate your organs when you die, what plans can you make in advance for it? What do you do?
Well, as I said, most states have checkoffs on the back of their driver's licenses. But in fact, you can also get a separate organ and tissue donor card from your local organ procurement organization, oftentimes your hospitals. Certainly the university medical centers will have special people, and they'll send you out the cards. You sign them and carry them with you. But the most important thing, absolutely, no matter what else you do, is you have to tell your loved ones that that's what you want, because the standard of care in this country, virtually everywhere, is that if the physicians, the surgeons, are going to ask the family after you die whether they want to donate your organs and tissues, and if you've told them and explained to them why, your family, then they'll be more willing to do it. But even if you've signed, as they say, you can have a signed organ and tissue donor card in every pocket and one pasted to your forehead when you die. And if your family doesn't agree, you don't get to donate.
Are there things looking back now that you think you were naive about when you started your research for your book?
Oh, probably almost everything in there. The last book that was comprehensive about what happened to dead bodies was written 118 years ago in England. I didn't have a source to get most of this information, and I couldn't find the answers to almost anything. And that's the naivety is what drove me on to write the book, is I just listed all the questions that I had. I said, I'd been dealing with corpses my entire career, and my career started before even medical school, because I drove an ambulance for 5 years. So, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. And I said, I don't know all these answers. My colleagues don't know these answers. The lay public doesn't know these answers. You know, the chaplains don't, the lawyers don't. I mean, nobody knows. And the funeral industry doesn't know all these answers either, as has been proved out. So I said, let me start looking into this. And it just kind of developed and developed into the project that turned into the book.
Do you think that the research you did for your book changed your attitude about funerals or about what you want to happen to your body after death?
Yeah, it actually did. I was somewhat ambivalent about what happened to my body. But what I finally came to figure out is that it's really the person that's important. And I wanted kind of simplicity in what would happen to my body after death. So what I put in, and actually I put a little coda in the back of the book, because while I was writing, a lot of people were asking me, so I put a little paragraph in the back, said that When I died, just cremate the body and scatter the ashes up on what we call Finger Rock, which is part of our Catalina Mountains. I'm with search and rescue here and spend a lot of time up in those mountains. I thought that would just be kind of nice. But you know what? And of course, that's after every organ and tissue that can be used is donated.
Mm-hmm.
That's afterwards, right? But the whole book has helped me realize even more so, it's fun to be alive. Do everything you can while you're alive to, you know, make it fun.
I know one of the reasons why you wrote this book was to tell people a lot about what happens to the body after death so that they wouldn't be afraid to donate their organs. Besides that, what's the point to you of going into the type of detail that you go into about what happens physically to a body after death?
Well, I thought there should be one source that both lay people and professionals could go to and get the answers to the questions about what happens to corpses, whether it be embalming that we talked about, or cremation, which is typical, or burials, or more strange things like cannibalism or cryonic preservation or things like that. There hasn't been any source for anybody to go to that has all this information in 118 years. And so the details were important, but people don't have to read the details, of course. If they feel uncomfortable, they can read the questions about things that – or the answers to the questions about things that they don't think will really happen to them, like mm-hmm. Cannibalism, that's not going to happen to me, or getting buried at sea or – you know, launched into space. And then as they feel a little more comfortable, go ahead and read the questions about things that they think may happen to them and get into those details.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Kenneth Iserzin is the author of Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies, published by Galen Press in Arizona. Iserzin directs the bioethics program at the University of Arizona. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.